mix, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.
Oh, great. Yeah, this is not going to get better. But Jared is here. So we have Dr. Jared Ball, a professor of communication studies at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, and author of the new book, The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power. It describes the origins and the myth of Black buying power, the rhetoric around that myth, and the contextualization of how it's propagated. He is also curator of imixwhatilike.org. Dr. Ball, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad to have you. I had an opportunity to go through your book. And, you know, let me ask you this. Let's start at the beginning. What is the myth of Black in the myth and the propaganda of Black buying power? Explain what you mean by Black buying power, and why do you say there's a myth and propaganda associated with the metrics?
Well, the myth, simply put, is repeated constantly that Black America has, as it was just reported this past week, will soon have $1.8 trillion in annual quote-unquote buying power, that if it were to use more responsibly and with greater degrees of financial literacy, could be used to close existing gaps in financial wealth and income inequality, be used to start and support businesses, et cetera, and so forth. That's the popular myth. Why I'm saying it is a myth is because the concept of buying power is, I think it has to be said at this point, intentionally misreported to suggest that it means something akin, as again it was said this past week, to a country's gross domestic product. So the suggestion is, again, that Black America sits on a pool of wealth the size, again, said this week, of a GDP the size of Mexico, Russia, and I believe Canada was the other country. And yet, because of this financial illiteracy, is mired in inequality. But the reality is, buying power is a marketing and advertising concept developed originally by the federal government and the business elite to manage how much workers were being paid, to assure that they were paid enough not to rebel and paid enough to buy the products they were helping produce, thereby supporting the continued flow of the economy. What it's become when, and we can talk about this maybe in a minute, but in the mid-20th century, it was turned into a weapon, largely by the Black and white commercial press, against Black people, specifically to discourage Black people from participating in political organization and concentrating on the never attainable fantasy of getting our money right, getting business and economics right, and then engaging the political apparatus. So that's why I'm saying it's a myth, that the idea that there is this pool of money that could be used to better the conditions of Black people doesn't exist, never has existed, and is intentionally used as a psychological weapon against mass political organization and social power, which is really the only power that any oppressed group has.
Interesting. Wait, Dr. Ball, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Shane. Why do you say that last part? I was going to ask you, why do you think this myth was propagated? How do you think it was propagated? But I'm curious, that sort of you got directly to the why there. Why and how is this idea used to suppress Black political activity?
So part of it, and I understand you have to phrase it this way, but part of it is that this is not what I think, and it's not speculation. This is documented, and part of what I explain in the book is that this is documented from the perspectives of those who have helped create this reality. One centerpiece that I point to that we could just use as an example here is, again, the Nixon administration in the early 1970s that was very conscious in saying, we want to promote the concept of Black power along the lines of Black capitalism so that people don't go the way of Kwame Ture and go the way of the Black business and political class. By the way, of course, that was repeated more recently at the funeral of John Lewis, where President Bill Clinton said the same thing. that he credited the late Lewis with saving the movement that was going too dangerously over towards quote unquote Stokely Carmichael, or you know, later changed his name to Kwame Ture. So this was explicitly stated, and then even earlier in the work of early propagandists and mass communication psychological warfare specialist Edward Bernays, not the least of which, said, you know, they were saying we in broad strokes, the goal post World War II was to recreate the American citizen.
And also add in your version to this group and why you're concerned that Cube has affiliated himself with this group.
Well, I mean, they go by American descendants of slaves, and their whole claim, as he said, as he championed again on CNN, is to focus exclusively on the concerns for Black Americans, not the African diaspora, not any other so-called people of color, but just Black Americans. And without, you know, we don't have enough time to really get into too much of it, but I have a long history of engaging with them and have watched their conservative rightward shift and development of this hashtag. And the whole point is to put, again, a conservative spin on a reparations movement and a Black political and Black liberation movement, which has long seen its destiny is tied with the African diaspora and other colonial movements, if not just for friendship and solidarity, but for camaraderie, but for political solidarity and tactics. So this idea that as Adolph pronounces, that we should cut ourselves off from radical traditions and other groups in struggle and say that only white America and only the U.S. government can satisfy our concerns is tactically absurd and ideologically backwards. So I've been, you know, in my you know, small endeavor trying to re-promote the hashtag SODA, solidarity of dispersed Africans, as an appropriate response. So as this group has explicitly claimed that they want to or supplant, rather, people like King and Malcolm X with themselves as leaders, and rebrand those leaders as being ineffective and insufficient and inappropriate for today, their argument is an even older form of Black conservatism dressed in some sort of brand new Black progressivism in the worst kind of way. So unfortunately, Cube has been linked up with them as they have a very slick and easily digestible initial headline. But most people who engage him, as Cube admits himself, don't really have a deep, a lot of experience with Black activism or politics, political organization, and are swept up in some of the headlines like Black people need this and Black people need that, which is, of course, true. But tactically speaking, the idea that we're going to get anything that we need by cutting ourselves off from everybody but white America in an expectation that white Americans will vote at the level they would have to redistribute trillions of dollars in GDP just to Black people is patently absurd. And it takes away from the very people and organizations that have been struggling for this in a wide variety of ways for decades and allows for this group to again claim to be the leaders of this movement while dragging us again in a very rightward and conservative reactionary direction. And that's what they're doing with Cube. So Cube should be raising these questions with the real left and trying to build with us, as opposed to being dragged over to the right and sitting with Trump and whoever. The valid questions he's raising should be dealt with among more radical and experienced activists and organizations. But this is what ADOS is here to do, and this is what it's successfully doing in this case and unfortunately some others.
That's okay. So I don't know that much about this stuff. I'd heard the term ADOS before. Hadn't heard the SODA, the S-O-D-A one that you brought up. Interesting stuff. I mean, I guess I don't, you know, we only have a couple of minutes left here. And like you're saying, this isn't enough time to have a real conversation about this stuff. But just real quick, where this makes particular sense for me, the ADOS side of things, is in the reparations argument. So I'll argue against it at first, just very briefly. You can make an intersectional argument that a lot of people, whether you're a descendant of a slave or not, if you're living in a society that has prejudices against you, that's going to suppress you economically, socially, in all these different ways. On the other hand, American descendants of slavery would be the people who would have had the deepest and the most, you know, clearly economic grievances. They were made promises that were never kept, that kind of thing. And so from a reparation side, if you're going to push for that, which in a weird way, we might be in a moment where we could do that. I guess I could see ADOS making sense, but just briefly, what's your take, Dr. Ball?
It's not that the argument fundamentally doesn't have validity. In fact, what I'm trying to say is they take very old arguments and rebrand them in a conservative way. So, of course, Black people deserve reparations. Of course, Black people deserve reparative justice in ways maybe no other group does. But that's not the point I'm raising. The point I'm raising is with their argument is to get that reparations, we need to cut ourselves off from every other group, have no solidarity with any other group, certainly not the diaspora, cut ourselves off from our own Black American radical traditions, and put our stock solely within a conservative white American populace with the expectations that they will vote, as would have to be expected, to the about two-thirds of the populace to redirect funds just to Black Americans, when we can't even get white Americans to stop killing and imprisoning Black Americans, never mind redirecting funds that they want themselves. So the idea that poor and working class Americans who themselves are doing worse and worse off even after COVID are going to then turn around and side with this reparations move is absurd. But what they're really doing is claiming reparations while dragging Black Americans back to the most conservative elements of political activism, when in fact the reparations movement should be buttressed by supplemented with their efforts by expanding existing efforts, which have all kinds of tactics which involve approaches to the UN, solidarity with other groups, reparations globally for African diaspora enslavement, et cetera, which would strengthen the argument for Black people here. And that has been the part that this ADOS group always wants to deny and ignore, because they want to be the singular spokespeople when they themselves have individually as the leadership itself, but ideologically more broadly, deep connections with the conservative white supremacist element of this country. So it's a false flag. It's a mythological claim that they're running when dragging us all the way back to the right. So again, this is not a discussion of whether or not we deserve reparations. It's a question of what tactics, what pathway will get us to that reparations, and cutting ourselves off aggressively and with hostility from all these other groups that could be potential allies and have been for decades is absurd. Finally, what we should be doing is recalling for a institutional public policy redistribution of the gross domestic product of this country, which before COVID was well over $20 trillion, which if redistributed appropriately through public policy institutionally would take care of the material needs of everybody in this country. So it's not to say that Black people don't have deserve more maybe than other groups, but it's to say that tactically, if everybody is taken care of, then Black people will end up finding themselves better taken care of, and then can on their own, in our own ways, take care of the missing pieces of that reparative justice that can't come from public policy or material redistribution of sort resources that we all help to create. But that kind of redistributionist effort would be much more radical, progressive, and encompassing, but it's something that people like this don't want to engage because it takes away their cottage industry of being conservative Black spokespeople leading us nowhere.
Interesting. Okay, this is all outside of my field of comprehension. Very interesting take. A lot to breathe in and think about there. Dr. Ball, thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
For those listening, that was Dr. Jared A. Ball, professor of communication studies at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, and author of the new book, The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power, which you can check out. Go over to his website, imixwhatilike.org. You can also follow him on Twitter at imixwhatilike. We will be back in a minute. We're taking calls. 202-521-1320 is the number to call. Again, 202-521-1320. Back on the other side, you're listening to Fault Lines with Jamarl Thomas and Shane Stranahan.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.